KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. To y'all, or good morning, or good day, whoever you may be, wherever you might be, welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and it's good to be with y'all here tonight, and great to talk with you. Excited about the show, but first, as always, a quick thank you to Corey, New Wave Radio Theater, always 1 hour before this program on Monday nights in a great setup for Radio Orbit. What did we hear tonight, Corey? What was it?
Frontier Woman.
Frontier Woman. How about it? And in fact, I'm actually going to be talking with sort of a frontier woman tonight. So that's a good segue, as always, Corey. So anyway, Corey does it every week, Monday at 10 p.m. to 11, New Wave Radio Theater. Tonight, no different. Okay, and I think the second part of that next week, and I may be sitting in for Corey. We'll have to see. Oh, gosh. Okay, thank you, Corey. You're awesome. All right. Anyway, before Corey, Kelvin and Eric the Red did it up tonight. Jazz plus blues equals saltwater burns. Tech Radio at 6 p.m., keeping us up on the radical world of high technology. Jeff Wheeler, of course, every Monday starts things off from 3 to 5 p.m. with Uncommon Light. Great music, good talk, good news. A lovely Monday night. Spring upon us, it looks like, finally, as well as the new moon. And it's a pleasure to hang out with y'all tonight on Radio Orbit, 7th of April, 2008, already nearly a third of the way through this year. Either way, you're listening to it here, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, your imagination station. It's a radio renovation, and I'm glad to be here with you and a part of it all, okay? All right, a big posthumous welcome, well, I should say a posthumous thank you, to my old friend Terrence McKenna. A wonderful talk of T's last week called Understanding and Imagination in the Light of Nature. For those of you unfamiliar with Terrence McKenna, if you're new listeners to the program, you'll have to take a listen back at the program last week and some of the earlier ones in the archives. He was an amazing person and someone who's been off of our particular plane for about 8 years now, but still having an impact for sure if it's anything to do with me. So anyway, if you missed the program last week, you'll have the opportunity to hear that and any other past shows that we've done. Just hop on the web and point your mouse over to Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com, and you'll have to click on the program archives button, and then you can surf through those and pick something that maybe you think looks interesting and check it out, listen in, and if you like it, share it with somebody else, okay? All right, tonight, Nikki Scully. I will tell you just a bit more about her in just a minute, as we'll be starting the program off, right off with Nikki, I should say. And we'll do space weather, a few other things later in the program, but we'll begin with Nikki Scully, and she's a very interesting woman, and we'll hear her story and a little bit about what she does over the next couple hours, okay? Between now and then, we'll hear some music. Also, I was going to play some music from this great band from that does music from the Andes. They're a Quechua Maya band. They call themselves Quechua Mashis or Quechua Mashis. But I have the case for the CD, and I left the CD in my player at work, my day job, and I was sort of moonlighting in the afternoon today, listening to music from the Bolivian and Ecuadorian and Peruvian Andes, trying to choose music for the program tonight. And I did choose some music, but I left it there. So, I had a very small selection of tunes that I had to choose from. And you're all fortunate because you get to hear Finn O'Loughlin again tonight. And he's one of my favorite new artists. I featured him on the program once or twice before, but bonus Finn O'Loughlin tonight. We started a song called we started the program with a song called Green of the Grass, and we'll play one more here called Waterside, and I can get my act together, and we'll come back in just a couple minutes here with Nikki Scully. If you want to catch up on the web and get a little look at what Nikki's up to, you can find her on the web at shamanicjourneys.com, and we'll be talking a little bit about her website and a couple of the books that she's written and some of the trips that she's been on and taking other people on in just a few minutes, okay? So we'll do that. And meanwhile, once again, this is Finn O'Loughlin. The song is called Waterside. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia.
take me down to the water side so I can see the wistful sky again. Take me down to the water side so I can feel the breeze blowing in. Cause there's something in the air out here that fills my swollen eyes with tears. I cough and splutter like a sad old man, slow consumption of who I am. And I'd pave the way to something great if I only had the will to concentrate. But for now I'll make a swift escape, a gentle ride to a gentle place. So take me down to the water side so I can see the tide coming in. Take me down to the water side so I can be my one and only friend. Cause there's something in the way they laugh, pointed fingers and photographs, hidden agendas and cordial masks. Take what they can get at every chance, and I'd love to join their special race. Material things, superficial embrace, but I'm so overwhelmed with fear. Feels like it's time to disappear. So take me down to the water side so I can lift away the muddy veil. Take me down to the water side so I can wash away the self-betrayal. There's so many people right round here, but no one ever seems to get that near. Judgments spin the minds of fools, scornful faces, ridicule. And I'd love to join with hands and hearts if I could only bring down half my guards. The cushioned life of an iconoclast wears me down so bloody fast. Oh, so take me down to the water side so I can see the wistful sky again.
Finn O'Loughlin, that one is called Waterside. You're listening to it here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and this is Radio Orbit. My guest tonight is named Nikki Scully. She's been teaching healing and shamanic arts and the Egyptian mystery since 1983. Techniques from her alchemical healing form are used internationally by thousands of practitioners. She is a lineage holder in the Hermetic tradition of Thoth and maintains the Lyceum of Shamanic Egypt. Drawing on the knowledge she has gained through decades of study and practice, she enlightens and uplifts many who study and travel with her. Nearly 20 years ago, Nikki founded Shamanic Journeys and has been guiding inner journeys and spiritual pilgrimages to places like Egypt, Peru, and Greece, and other sacred sites around the planet. We'll talk with her about many of these different places tonight. She lives in Eugene, Oregon, and maintains a comprehensive healing and shamanic consulting practice. She welcomes all of us to study with her at her beautiful garden center. So it is with good wishes and pleasure that I say hello and welcome to Radio Orbit. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, Mike. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. How are you tonight?
I'm really good.
All right, and we're talking to you from, what is it there, little after 9 o'clock?
Yeah, it is. It's about 9:15 or 20. I'm in Eugene, Oregon.
Springtime there yet?
It's pretty cold. It's usually a lot warmer by now, but it's trying to break through.
All right, well, it already has sort of here in the Midwest, I think, so it can't be too far behind you there. Let me start off by saying thanks, and also, for those who are unfamiliar with you and your work, I'd like to, and it's the first time you've been on the program, I'd love it if you would take some time and talk a little bit about yourself and your background and where you come from and sort of how you got along this particular path that you're on.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a big question. Where do you want me to start?
Well, start with your childhood. Start with where were you born? What were your parents like? How'd you come up with some
of that? Oh, okay. You want the whole story.
Yeah,
all
sure,
right.
Sure. We got plenty of time, you know.
Born in New York, grew up in Southern California.
Really?
middle class Jewish background, dropped out in the 60s.
Along with a number of others.
Along with a number of others. I'd say the pivotal moment was probably LSD in 1964.
Hmm. That's the year I was born. It's true.
So I guess you kind of weren't around for that part. You had hippie parents.
I heard enough. Trust me. Well, so, what were you doing in 1964? I read that you actually were running around with the Grateful Dead at least for some time.
That was about 1968 that started. And that's how I got to Egypt. My ex-husband was one of the managers of the Grateful Dead, and so I got to go with them when they played three concerts at the pyramids in 1972.
Oh, my God, that must have been amazing.
It was. It was my welcome home to Egypt party.
Holy cow.
I mean, I didn't realize that till 20 years later, but it was pretty amazing, and that was, so now you've got two of my really pivotal moments.
Hmm. But you were sort of flowing right with that wave that of the psychedelic 60s, and you were right in the middle of that whole thing.
Oh, yeah. That was the cauldron within which I, you know, that kind of messy, lovely soup that those of us who were part of that, I can really only speak for myself. I think that those experiences in the late 60s and early, throughout the 70s, gave me the underpinnings of who I am today, gave me the vision that I've tried to stay true to in the unfolding of my own path. However, it was very important to me I find a way to present what I learned that was more mainstream. We used to have this thing that the only way we could really make a difference is if we became like chameleons and entered the mainstream and, you know, worked from inside. And so my intention was to find a way to share what I learned without it being dangerous or illegal in ways where people, you know, that would be accessible to people. So I've become a part of that bridge between that time, that knowledge, and that experience, and the people who I'm not really very mainstream, actually. I'm kind of esoteric to be mainstream, but I am a bridge for how people can bring mystical spirituality and magic into their lives in a practical way.
Hmm. All right.
And in a healing way. Always as, you know, I guess healing is sort of at the forefront of what I'm attempting to accomplish. Hmm. And I guess it started because I went off looking for tools, because we all made such a mess of things back then that we needed. We were at a vanguard and were making as big a mistake as anybody could ever want to make, and it was, you know, not always a bed of roses, for sure. A lot of thorns.
Yeah, yeah. I think, two things. You've already mentioned a couple words that have sort of alchemical significance. You said the word cauldron. That's a good alchemical word, sort of. And one of the, I think people often may not think about it like this, but in alchemy, as in shamanism, and you're interested in both of these things, healing is a big part of the business. So maybe you could talk a little bit about definitions. We're going to be talking about those things, among other things, tonight: alchemy and healing and shamanic technique and this sort of thing. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the definitions of
what these things mean, what our terms are.
Yeah,
sure.
Let's talk about alchemy and then maybe shamanism and get definitions from your point of view.
Okay. Alchemy is the process by which we turn the lead of our being into the gold of potential illumination. The lead being the prime material that in Kemet, where alchemy comes, it means from the black land, Kemet, which is the land of Egypt, which was named for the fertile black soil that when the Nile flooded and left the silt, it fed the people, and that's alchemy. And we, in English, the prime material that we're wanting to transform is simply the matter. So anytime you ask the question, what is the matter, you're actually saying, what is it? What is it that needs to be transformed? And alchemy is the process by which that base substance or base prime material is spiritualized. So the spiritualization of matter is the goal of alchemy, and my work is alchemical healing. It's how to transform that matter in a way that heals. And I'll tie that into shamanism using the best definition I ever found for it was Joan Halifax back in the 70s.
Experiential anthropologist, Joan Halifax, amazing woman. Yeah,
amazing woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that the shaman was one who could traverse the realms between the dimensions into other worlds to bring back healing and power for the benefit of the community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's a really important aspect of it. It's not a self-serving kind of sorcery. It's a service to one's community that generally has its roots in healing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about a little bit more about the Egyptian roots? In other words, alchemy, if it comes from the dark soil, the dark land, or the dark, what did you call it?
The black land.
The black land.
Kemet. K-H-E-M-I-T. That's one of the ancient Egyptian names for Egypt.
For Egypt, yeah, okay. So, but alchemy is essentially, in that light, an earth tradition, something that comes from the ground. In other words, they're looking at the transformation of earth and water, I guess, into plants and life or whatever.
Well, that's an example, but I think when they're speaking of it coming from Egypt, they're speaking more of the high civilization that expressed a form that had that I think alchemy originally came up out of Africa, but moved out through Egypt and the Arabic world and up into Europe from there. There was a guy named Jabir. I think that's how you pronounce it. The word gibberish came from Jabir's work because he wrote these alchemical texts. He was an Arab, I believe, and nobody could understand his writing, so it came known as gibberish. But he's also the person created algebra.
Aha! Again, it's the A-L in front of the word alchem, algebra.
Gibra.
Yeah.
Jabir.
Mm-hmm.
So
very interesting.
It's kind of hard to trace because what most people think of alchemy is the idea of people in the Middle Ages in their laboratories trying to create gold from lead to get rich. And that the true alchemists called those people puffers.
Right, right. That was the guy in the basement getting stoned on mercury vapors or whatever. Right?
But, you know, the alchemy was actually a high art, and the modern-day alchemists are those that are creating elixirs and tinctures and medicines that heal people.
Hmm.
And alchemical healing, the form that I've created, that I have expressed in my book, Alchemical Healing, and which is a major chunk of who I am and what my work is,
mm-hmm.
is a spiritual, energetic healing form that honors that the cauldron lives within every one of us. And how we learn to consciously mix the elements within our bodies, our sacred vessel, our cauldrons, allows us to participate in a conscious way in the process of alchemy and be informed by spirit, become spiritualized matter in the process.
Hmm. So the whole... You know, people are taught, for the most part in the West here, in school, or even in, you know, general conversation, that alchemy is nothing more than sort of the silliness that you touched on earlier. It's just the, you know, the ambition to turn base metals into precious things that they can get a whole lot of money for. But that was sort of misdirection and certainly missing the point.
Well, I think there was a lot of secrecy in the Middle Ages with regard to what was going on, and a lot of, well, one had to be concerned about heretical behavior.
Hmm.
And of course, if you could create gold from lead, well, you were safe.
Right, right.
You could buy your way out of just about anything.
Right.
But there was a lot of hidden meanings, and the experimentation, the gibberish had to do with the secrecy of what they were trying to do, the trying to find the fountain of youth, for example.
Right.
I think that the shamanic traditions generally tend to be a little less self-serving.
Mm.
However, anyone who spent much time in South America or even with Native Americans know that there's a lot of competition within the ranks of shamans, and I know in South America many were trained not only to heal but to kill as well. And so there's this undercurrent of competition, which to me really degrades the service that is available through many of these really powerful shamans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really wonderful when you find one that really is above the game.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of gaming going on under the surface. Also, I find that in... Well, I guess it's everywhere, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It just shows up in a certain way in shamanic cultures. But I guess it's just no different than the same attitudes of competition and greed and, you know, ego that take down...
a corporation or something. You know?
Right.
Yeah,
or cultures and traditions everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably a reasonable estimation, you know, because everybody sort of they're working within their own culture, you know, and even though the practices, you know, might be different in the way that they're carried out, they're still there's still going to be, there's still sort of the monkey hierarchy that seems almost impossible to get away from in our species, you know? And there's certainly, when it comes to male monkeys, you know, that competition seems almost unavoidable.
Well, I'm hoping we're going to learn to avoid it.
I think we better.
It's taken us out.
I agree.
We better get over ourselves. Quick.
Yeah.
So really what I'm about is providing tools for people to help them remember themselves and why we're here and what we can do to alleviate the suffering on this planet and find our way back to the garden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we have an inherent right that we've just trashed,
mm-hmm.
along with our stewardship.
Mm-hmm. And the evidence is all around.
Oh, boy.
Mm.
Yeah, it really is. And I think, you know, we're moving toward a tipping point. I think we can avoid it. I think we can, we have tremendous opportunity. I think there's a huge undercurrent of consciousness that is expanding throughout and around this planet that is taking hopefully enough people to arrive at a quantum leap in consciousness where everybody's going to get on board. See the light, so to speak. I don't know how it's going to happen, but people are waking up every day. Or maybe I'm just deluded living in a world where all the people that I interact with are really striving to maintain consciousness, presence, and awakening.
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I think about it often because I do this radio show and I talk every week to people who I'm hoping, you know, to bring to the program that are, you know, talented and interesting and exciting and pushing the envelopes of their fields, whatever it is that they're doing, you know. And I find that in my own world I sort of have the same opinion as you, that there's a tremendous amount of new/old information that is now being revealed and shared and understood much better, and this what feels to me very much the way you describe it's an expansion of consciousness. But at the same time, I was in Denver. I was in Colorado a couple weeks ago, and one of my closest friends is a cab driver there, right, and has been for years, And he burst my bubble really quickly and said, "Oh my God, Mike! You know, you cannot believe, you know that." And he's just making observations from the people that get in and out of his cab, you know, day in and day out. And his impression could not have been more the opposite of mine, that everyone is completely lost and oblivious, and very few people
ignorant.
Yeah, and he's a sharp guy, and he's a practitioner of his own sort of personal alchemy, I would describe. But he's also a good he's sort of a good data collector for me. You know, but so I'm not. So I think that, as always, it's probably a little bit of both. But it's hard to say. But obviously, in the world that you hang out in, I can imagine that there's a tremendous amount of effort and knowledge being put forth.
And we, you know, it's easy to get lulled to think that everybody thinks like we do, and then I read the papers to remind myself to keep some kind of balance on, you know, why I'm doing it. Because preaching to the converted isn't always the best use of much time, but that's sort of what happens, you know. It's sort of like, you know, the conservatives listen to right-wing radio and the liberals listen to the left, you know. Yeah, every once in a while I'll watch Fox just to see what they're saying.
Yeah, just so you can cross anything you hear there off your list as far as credibility, you know.
And sometimes I get surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I really see where there's connections. I remember I had some friends that lived in the mountains of New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very hip people that lived kind of tribally and communally in the midst of a very redneck area.
Mm-hmm.
And there became a dispute around the forest and the loggers and the economy and the, you know, more back to the land, environmentalist people. And but these people were really hip. What they did is they got together with the redneck loggers and they sat down with them and they started talking about the problems that they shared. You know, the children and what was happening and how, you know, and finding a place where they could come together and realize that in their hearts they were all wanting the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And from that place, they were able to work their way into, okay, how can we support each other? And they pulled it off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They crossed that divide by remembering and finding and being able to share the similarities. And so that's one of the things I notice. Sometimes I'm listening to somebody that I know is just like totally on the other side of the universe from me, thought-wise, and I see these threads of similar concern, and you know, and very often I see just the opposite. But you know, I'm looking for that because I think that that's the place where we can grab hold and make something happen together.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, if you can't realize that we're all sort of in the same boat, you know, regardless of where we come from, the country or, you know, our religious background or ethnic, you know, background, all these things, I mean, gosh, I mean, everybody has children that they're trying to take care of, you know, and that's, I mean, if you can't recognize that, well, then, my gosh, you're way behind the eight ball. And I think that, you know, that's the business of the media and the newspaper and all these people. They tend to make, you know, those people on the other side of the world, whoever they may be, into its. You know, they're not
right.
They're not people with children and you know, and they don't suffer. They're not the same as you and I.
I know, it's like the war is all about us and our loss.
Right.
And it's like, well, yeah, and
yeah.
You know, how is it to live under those conditions and try and raise a family and have children and, you know, educate them and have a life?
Right.
Under those kind of conditions.
And then I think sometimes about, you know, it's hard enough to get people to consider, you know, the value of the lives of other people, other families, other men and women and their children in these places, you know, halfway around the planet or whatever. But then, you know, if you try to extend that to, well, my gosh, what sort of impact are your bombs and your war having on other species? You know, what about the plants and the animals that are being devastated? You know, nobody wonders about how many caterpillars have been killed or whatever. You know, but it's like, I mean, the war is an aggression on everything. It's not just an aggression against human monkeys. It's aggression against all of these species. Even the rocks and the stones are getting beaten to death. You know, and it's just such a sad state of affairs that it goes so unrecognized and so hard to understand, you know?
Well, I'm really hopeful that this time that we're in is a quickening and that in this sort of speeding up, I know there's a lot of people who put forth the 2012 as a zero point for this quantum leap in consciousness, and you turn on the History Channel and maybe you'll see something about the apocalyptic nature of that date. From whichever way you come and always in between, there seems to be a lot of energy pointing to a period of time. I tend to try and avoid those kinds of setups.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
sort of like Y2K,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or, you know, and it is true that, at least from our perspectives, although all our perspectives are a bit relative, that time seems to be advancing at a quicker and quicker rate. Something, things are changing. Everything is coming together so rapidly. And I think that there's an opportunity for some magic beyond our comprehension to
so, yeah.
happen. And sometimes I feel that the work that I do and a lot of my colleagues and the people that I know are helping to prepare people for a moment that we, even though we're moving toward it, we don't know what it is. We can't really define it. And yet, something is going to be very different in the future coming up. And although I don't believe anybody is coming to rescue us, I think that in the possibility of the magic that we're moving towards, we might just be able to rescue ourselves.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, if history is any indicator, we're going to have to. And this is sort of what evolution is about. You know?
I think that evolution is a bit slow for these times.
Hmm.
I think we're in a more of a mutate or die situation. I had cancer in 92.
Really?
And as I was dealing with this very, very aggressive cancer, breast cancer, and the treatment that I was working with, along with my the shamanic and alchemical practices, I realized that something in me had to die in order to be renewed and move forward from that.
Mm.
And so my treatment became a vision quest, and my journey became a very shamanic journey of death and rebirth, from which I emerged pretty much unscathed, and have not had to deal with that. I guess it's been 17 years now.
Wow, remarkable.
But I think that we are going through a collective shamanic death experience. And there's many people that are taking that literally and creating that. And I think there are a lot of us who are consciously choosing a different way. And a lot of the tools that are being developed right now are tools to assist us in adapting to the toxicity we've created around us while we learn to mutate so that we can survive this time.
Mm-hmm.
That evolution in its normal sense is simply too slow.
Do you... do you see biological change, however? In other words, do you believe that the
environment...
So in other words, the environment has shifted to the point where people are going to have to be able to deal with a different environment as opposed to...
We already are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel that part of my healing, that my body was informed of that healing at the level of DNA, and that that in itself is a kind of mutation. So although I think our DNA is actualized or, you know, lit up and put into play through environmental signals, you know the work of Bruce Lipton.
Mm-hmm, sure.
We've talked about that a little bit. And that's what he's learned as a cellular biologist and can describe quite articulately how each cell has a membrane around it, and it is through that membrane and how the nucleus of the cell is informed through the environmental signals that pass through that membrane that cause the DNA to activate.
Mm-hmm.
That the DNA in and of itself is not, doesn't have that power.
Right, it's more like a blueprint. And
exactly.
Right, right.
And so we have a lot of sway over that, mm-hmm. and the capability of managing and directing what we're given to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is comes from how, well, we have choices, let's put it that way.
Okay.
We're influenced greatly by the environmental stimulus that surrounds us, and we can learn to override that also.
Okay. Since you just mentioned Dr. Lipton, he's been on the program here, and a person puts up on the in the forum here, in the chat room, I should say, one of our listeners says, please ask Nikki about her work with Dr. Bruce Lipton. And I know you have a trip planned, a shamanic journey of sorts, on the books with yourself and Dr. Lipton. Maybe you could talk. We've got a few minutes before the top of the hour.
I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, let's do that, okay?
Bruce and I are really having fun because he's come to a place of comprehension of mysticism through a very rigorous scientific journey,
yeah,
of
yeah.
discovery. And mm-hmm. so his way of coming to the same truths as I are from the absolute opposite ends of the spectrum.
Isn't that cool?
And what's great is that he can describe and articulate in very clear scientific terms the mystical and shamanic experience, and I can take his explanations of science and provide a direct experience for people so that they can comprehend it in their own bodies and experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we're playing together, and
wow.
that's how we're doing Egypt together.
And you're taking a trip to Egypt with Bruce?
Yes, in just a couple of weeks. It's, you know, it's long been sold out. I only will take one busload. And so there's, I think, 43 of us heading off in a couple of weeks.
Incredible. That's going to be a fantastic experience.
It is, because we're going to go through those mysteries, and he's just so dynamic and so brilliant and articulate. And we're going to do the Egyptian mysteries work, and he will be able to explain for people kind of before some stuff and after some stuff so that they can get it at a deeper level, that they're not up against the resistance of it being magic or incomprehensible.
Hmm. All right. Yeah, and that is coming up, like you said, in a few weeks, April 25th, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Just around the corner. So.
Just around the corner.
All right, well, I'm sure that... But let me ask you, you know, you've done many of these, and we'll talk more about your travel later in the program, but you do these trips relatively often, is that right? And you've been doing them for some time?
I've been taking groups to Egypt since 1989. I'm somewhere between 35 and 40 groups.
Amazing.
At this point.
Do you document any of the experiences on the trip? I know some of that obviously is the fodder that your books are built upon, but do you ever...
I send postcards to my E-list sometimes. a postcard from Egypt.
Uh-huh.
And I'll do photographs and, when I get time, sometimes I don't have time, but when I do, I have a mailing list of about maybe 7,000 people,
mm-hmm.
an E-list, and I'll drop them an email from Egypt.
All right. Wow. Okay. Well, that sounds like an amazing expedition, and I know you have some other things coming up, too. We'll talk about those a little bit later in the program. Right now, I think we'll take a little bit of a break. And when we come back, let's talk more about Egypt. I'm interested in talking about some of the details about the Hermetic tradition and even some of the characters. This the character of Thoth has always been a very interesting one to me. And so maybe we can start there and we'll talk a little bit about Egypt. Okay? All right, we'll do that and come back. Nikki, your website, of course, shamanicjourneys.com, correct?
Right, or NikkiScully.com.
Okay.
We'll get you there.
Yeah, Nikki with
spell
two...
Spell it right.
Yeah, Nikki, NikkiScully, NikkiScully.com,
yeah.
And ShamanicJourneys.com. You can link over there from my site as well. And Nikki has two books as well, and we'll talk... of course, we're sort of beating around them right now, but Shamanic Mysteries of Egypt, one of the books that I've had the pleasure of reading, and also Alchemical Healing, which is... actually, the Egypt book was one that you co-authored with Linda Starwolf. Is that correct? And we'll talk a little bit about all this when we come back. Okay.
Great.
All right, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Just about 5 minutes now before the hour of 12 midnight. Going quickly closing in on the 8th of April, 2008. We will be back with Nikki Scully in just a few minutes. In the meanwhile, we'll hear one here from Finn O'Loughlin, one of my favorite new musical artists. This is a song called Walk My Way. My Way, Finn O'Loughlin. You're listening to it here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and this program is called Radio Orbit. My guest is Nikki Scully. If you missed the first hour of the program, we've been talking with Nikki about some of her experiences, her background, alchemical arts and healing, a little bit about shamanism, and we're going to continue with her right now. On the web, by the way, shamanicjourneys.com and nikkiscully.com. Nikki, thanks for sticking around.
Oh, yeah. I'm enjoying talking to you.
Good. Thanks. I am too. All right. I would like to talk with you a little bit more about Egypt and the old, old ways. And there, you know, I came across many years ago a reference to this thing, the Emerald Tablets and Thoth. And I never really knew what to make of it. And I learned enough about Hermetic tradition and stuff in the since then, but I've always been fascinated. It's always been this sort of mysterious part of the whole thing. Could you talk a little bit about the Egyptian history and Thoth and maybe some of the other characters that play into their cosmology?
Sure. I guess since you brought up the Emerald Tablets, I'll talk about Thoth. In the Emerald Tablets, there's two published versions of the Emerald Tablets right now. There's the one that you're speaking of, which was this treatise that was translated by Dorial maybe back in the 30s, something like that. Is that the one you're talking about?
That's the one. Yeah.
And then there's the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus,
mm-hmm.
which is more the source of the Hermetic teachings. They both really have the same author, but the one that you're speaking of is, they said that the author was Thoth the Atlantean, that before the civilization of Egypt, that the legendary Atlantis, Thoth was the son of the ruler of that civilization, and he was a seeker of wisdom. And because of his development, he and others were able to see what was coming down, that there was going to be a cataclysm of some sort, and they were able to, by their magic, by their craft, or arc, go to various places on the planet and bring their wisdom to other places that could be then developed and brought into civilization. The interesting thing about Egypt was that it kind of entered full-blown. There was no written history, and then suddenly there was this incredible civilization.
And where was the developmental phase and all that?
Yeah, it just happened. And there are some that say that that is the work of Thoth. And what I know of Thoth as a lineage holder of Thoth is he's like the teacher's teacher. He's the highest concept of mind to the Egyptians. That intelligence that views from a higher perspective. So all people, any person who is in relationship with Thoth or has the capacity to function of the level of Thoth is going to be able to see solutions and function from a higher perspective.
Is there, just off the tip of my brain here, is there a connection between the word between Thoth and the word thought?
I would certainly think so.
It sure seems like it.
And I think that when we're attuned to Thoth for our thoughts, We become thoughtful.
Try saying that five times, right?
And in our thoughtfulness, we make wiser choices. He's the Egyptian principle that shows you, takes you to the experience that allows you to become wise about whatever it is that you're seeking to learn. So a person who is seriously interested in becoming enlightened, illumined, in connection with their highest potential, can usually access thought. And once that connection and relationship is made, then you have this capacity for guidance, where you can be informed and guided. And that doesn't mean driven. It means you're given opportunities that you can choose to follow up on or ignore, you choose what you choose and you get what you get. We have this pesky little thing called free will, which gets us in trouble if we don't exercise it appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, appropriateness is one of the key factors that seems to be missing in many people's decision making. I've had this as a side note, it just comes to mind, but there's a wonderful gentleman who's been on the program a number of times. His name is Joseph Chilton Pierce.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you know Joe, but
anyway. Oh, yeah. I've heard him speak. He's fabulous.
Yeah, he's fascinating. And once we were talking on the air, and he said that he described, Mike, the difference between intellect and intelligence is that,
how you use it?
Yeah, intellect is intelligence minus appropriateness. and that intelligence is intellect guided by appropriateness, essentially. And I've always really appreciated that distinction, because so many people sort of look at intellectualism as intelligence, and they're very actually separate things.
That's a really good point.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, what I found, I guess I got connected up with thought about 25 years ago by a teacher who took me on a journey.
Uh-huh.
And he sort of stepped forward to mentor me, and I really didn't get what that meant. It was quite some time before I actually started paying attention, and as soon as I did, well, my life changed. That was another one of those pivotal moments that we were talking about.
Right.
And it's right up there with going to Egypt and taking LSD. That connection with Thoth has absolutely changed my life. And once I grasped the validity of it, the truth of it, the wisdom of it, well, I've been attempting to maintain my course on that path of wisdom. And it's been quite a magical ride. It's not always easy. It's pretty easy to fall off the path, actually.
Do you look at it like a relationship?
Oh, it is a relationship.
Hmm. How so? Would you expand on that a little bit?
Well, it's thought represents the principle of wisdom that's married to truth and justice, harmony, balance. And when we choose that path, when we determine to take the high road, then there will be that voice that we can connect to that will help us determine what that is.
Hmm. How do you distinguish the voice that's helpful from the one that's going to lead you astray, the trickster?
The mind is a trickster, and he is the highest concept of mind.
Hmm.
So the first thing you have to do is, I guess, realize that in whatever way Thoth comes, that you learn that signature. You become so familiar that you can't be fooled.
Right.
And it's And at there's a point where that highest seat of intelligence is in your own heart.
Hmm.
So the path of heart is also the path of wisdom.
Hmm. Wonderful. Okay.
Now, Thoth, the Egyptian expression of Thoth, has a number of forms, the most common of which is the ibis-headed man figure that is, you see in all over the Egyptian temples and Egyptian art, because he's an extremely prominent figure in the Egyptian pantheon. He's the messenger of the gods. He's the mediator of the gods.
Hmm.
He's the one, when things get out of whack, that provides solutions.
Huh. Yeah, we could use his help today, I guess. Huh?
We have his help. I'm one of many streams of connections that connect people with Thoth.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it through Shamanic Journey. I do it in my books. I do it in all my healings. I do it... It's not that hard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And once you find that part in yourself, because it comes through you,
it's
not really separate from you.
I understand, yeah.
Then you set that as your vector. You just keep bringing yourself back to that. Oh, I'm confused. I don't know where I'm going. Oh, it's time to call on Thoth.
Hmm.
And then it's a matter of remembering, oh, yes, I have this. I have this rudder that I can use to help direct me. And you return to it.
Hmm.
So what I do in my work is I'm a cartographer of the inner planes. So I have these maps, these directions that people can follow and make these connections, and then they have to build the relationship. And it's just like sitting down to tea with a friend. I mean, you can have friends, and the more that you see them, engage with them, the closer your friendship gets.
Right, and the more that they reveal to you, and the more you reveal to them, perhaps, and this sort of thing.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like any other relationship, but it's happening in the inner world.
Right, interesting, okay.
Rather than the physical. But you can see it reflected in your physical reality because they're absolutely interconnected, as above, so below, as without, so within.
Uh-huh.
But you have to establish that through your own experience in order to know it to be true.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't take somebody's word for it.
Mm.
So the shamanic path is the path of direct experience, where you cross the veils between the worlds and meet directly with those principles. So Thoth, of course, is the architect of the forms that I work with, the alchemical healing, the Egyptian mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
But within that, all of nature is at the ready to share its intelligence and its gifts. If we but open our hearts and ask and pay attention.
Are there, in your experience, are there, for lack of a better description, tests or challenges put forth that once accomplished, perhaps are then, you get the payoff, that type of a scenario?
I think life is like that. I really do.
That's a good answer, yeah.
I mean, even with cancer, I would say that I became a much better healer as a consequence of my experience of cancer than I could possibly have become without.
Huh. Well, a big part of healing, I think, is compassion and empathy, and if you've been there yourself, you can really feel that for another person perhaps better.
That's what I've been learning.
Mm.
And you know, it's not like you get it once and then you got it either.
Mm.
There's always another level.
Yeah, yeah.
There's always more. The mystery, the cool thing about the mystery is it's never really solved. You just get to plumb it and you get to go deeper and deeper into it and make more discoveries which open more doorways into more mysteries.
Right, right. It's just a never-ending rabbit hole depending on which way and how deep you want to go.
Exactly. And the joy of working with Thoth is that there's a lot of humor. It's not about, and it's not punitive. There's consequences.
Mm-hmm.
It's not punitive.
Mm-hmm. Not judgmental, yeah.
Exactly.
Mm.
It's like there's, like I speak of him as a dear friend, an associate, somebody that I work with, and I, when I'm in communion, it's as though I'm talking to a being that has a presence, and yet that's really a step-down version of what that principle really stands for.
Hmm.
However, that's a way that we can interact, and it's no different than interacting with a friend in this dimension.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Once you get the hang of it.
And that, I think, is one of the hardest things for people to get their hands around, because certainly most of the people that I know brought up in Western civilization in the 20th century, I mean, just the idea of that sort of thing has been preconditioned and indoctrinated out of us so thoroughly that and doubt is one of the things that is very troublesome when you get into these places, because you have to be certain, and like you say, your relationship, your intuition, your understanding now is very clear. You don't have any doubt. You said it's like any other relationship. You know it.
Yeah.
You know. Well, I think this is a big challenge to be able to really know it, because we're filled with doubt. You know, and we're taught that sort of doubt is the way you're supposed to live your life.
Unfortunately, that's true. And there are all these opportunities, because you don't doubt your direct experience.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And so that's the beauty of a shamanic path, is the proof is in the pudding. I
right.
mean,
right.
you have the experience or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually pretty easy for most people. And then there's a lot of resistance. I mean, the idea, first of all, in this Judeo-Christian world that we live in, the idea of gods right off the top is very off-putting, not to mention intimidating.
Hmm.
If it's not off-putting, it's intimidating.
Right.
So it's usually both. But so the first thing to know is that if you do come into the presence of a god, deity, or thought, the way that you communicate is eye to eye and heart to heart. It's not that there's this great giant being and you're this little thing, because it doesn't work that way. You have to, and they're not going to come down to your height. You just have to pull yourself together and be on a par with.
Mm.
And that was the hardest thing for me, to get over that intimidation and realize that, no, you know, I have to be willing to show up.
Right, right.
And
be an equal partner in a way.
Yes, exactly.
Mm.
And it doesn't matter if you're talking about a god or an animal totem or a plant spirit or any form of spiritual intelligence with which you might want to engage.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you don't show up less than or more than, or, you know, it's just like communicating with another, with respect,
right,
with presence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Remarkable and beautiful observations. All right. Look, there's a whole bunch of other characters in this pantheon of Egypt. Mm. And I do want to mention the book again. This a particular book that I'm looking at right now is called Shamanic Mysteries of Egypt. And it is cool the way you write, because they're sort of guidebooks in a way. I guess that's sort of appropriate, because you do traveling explorations as well. But
this is a guidebook for the inner journey.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't need to go to Egypt. I mean, it would be, people have told me, groups of people have taken the book to Egypt and gone through the temples and done all the journeys and the initiations at the temples.
Mm.
And it's written so that if you can't go to Egypt, you can still touch those mysteries and have those experiences in the comfort of your home.
Right.
With your friends.
Huh.
You know, it's a group. It can be shared.
Right. All right. Well, look, we talked about Thoth, who's sort of the masculine, or one of the male...
hermaphrodite. It's really, yes, there's a masculine presence, but it's sort of, that's not the point.
Okay, all right. Well, I was trying to find a way to talk about Isis and Hathor and some of the feminine characters. Maybe you could talk about, and I mean, and there's a whole host of them, but I'll sort of let you just sort of riff on your own as much as you'd like, a little bit more about this stuff, what you think is important, but certainly many of the...
Talk about it in the context of the book, because the book is written kind of like a tarot, as a major arcana,
mm-hmm.
where this
mm-hmm.
family of the Neteru, the principles of nature of Egypt, have come together to help us and support us and guide us into discovering our own divinity and grounding that divinity in our human reality to become the fully realized human beings that we can be. And so to do that, this family has come together, and it includes 22 of these principles, these deities of the Egyptian pantheon, from 0 to 21, just like you would have a major arcana in Tarot.
Right, right, right.
0 being the fool in Tarot, here would be the initiate or the person that reads the book.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd have 1, the magician, which in this work is the alchemist,
mm-hmm.
which is the goddess Nekhbet, Mother Mut, the vulture goddess, who's one of the oldest, who is, you know, oversees the process of transformation that the reader goes through, and protects the initiate while they're going through it. Then you would get to 2 would be the high priestess, and 3 the empress, but the empress in this book is Isis, so you'd have the high priestess as her twin sister Nephthys,
mm-hmm.
and then Isis, and they... Excuse me, are you trying to say something?
No,
I was talking to my husband.
He
was telling me I'm beginning to lecture.
Oh, you're doing just wonderfully. Say, hey, don't lecture me.
Okay. Anyhow, so all of these deities bring their unique gifts to the process to assist us in our self-discovery. And be they gods or goddesses, they all have these incredible attributes that are part of ourselves, that as we recognize in them, we rediscover in ourselves. And as we build relationships with them, then we have these voices in our heads, these images, this support, these helpers, and this very rich landscape of spiritual family that is cheerleading us as we move forward through our process.
Could you talk about the Sphinx? I've got a lot of people that are, of course, that's one of the Egyptian motifs that people are most familiar with, and maybe a little bit about the significance in your view of that particular icon.
Oh, I'd love to. I start almost all my trips at the Sphinx.
Huh.
Because I've always seen the Sphinx as the guardian of the mysteries.
Huh.
The Sphinx is like this earth altar. It's so old. It's so far older than the pyramids, that no one really knows who carved it.
Mm-hmm.
It's carved out of bedrock that just, you know, right up out of the ground, out of this solid mass of bedrock. And if you look at it from the side, you'll see it's very out of proportion. The head is way smaller than how it should be for the body, proportionally.
Right.
Because it's believed, or I'm pretty confident on this one, that the pharaoh's face that's on there was cut down from a previous image that may have been cut down from an even more previous image that would be the original Sphinx in all his, her glory. And I believe it was carved as a monument to the source of our consciousness, the source of our intelligence, which comes from the stars. And the temples of Egypt, throughout Egypt, combine to create a temple complex that is a temple of the cosmos, reflecting that source from which we came. And we often hear suggestions that the Sphinx is hiding or is guarding a library, some place of knowledge beneath the Sphinx. And it is my contention that that library is the Sphinx itself, that within the granite, in the crystalline of the granite itself, all knowledge is accessible. It's a doorway, it's a portal to the Akashic record or the larger knowledge base of this universe.
Oh, very interesting. All right, let me ask you about shamanism and the mysteries of ancient Egypt. In other words, when we think about shamanism, we think about men or women that practice certain techniques. Sometimes it's drumming, sometimes it's breath exercise, sometimes it's ordeal in the forest, sometimes it's the ingestion of a psychedelic plant, or...
I would say Egypt probably had all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the Old Kingdom and the Hepsed festival rites that were the rites of the renewal of the pharaoh, that the inscriptions that describe these rites are in the Pyramid of Unas at Saqqara, where the first place that they were discovered. And those instructions for those rites were the rites of the renewal of the pharaoh. There is a book that I recommend to any of your listeners who are really serious about understanding the shamanic roots of the ancient Egyptian civilization.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Shamanic Wisdom in the Pyramid Text by Jeremy Nadler.
Mm-hmm.
Nadler.
Interesting. Is it an older book or a new book?
No, it's a recent book. He's a scholar from Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And he translates these pyramid texts from the point of view that the Egyptian mystical religious culture was a shamanic culture, and that those were shamanic rites, not written for the dead, but rather for the living king as rites of passage through which he would die to be reborn. And it was a shamanic death. It was an initiatory rite of passage
And do you find that shamanic traditions that have evolved around the planet have their roots all in the Hermetic tradition, do you think?
No.
No.
The word shaman is Siberian.
Yes.
And I think that...
maybe simultaneous development in many places or this sort of thing?
I think that tribal shamanic culture precedes the Egyptian civilization.
Sure, we have the high Neolithic evidence from at least 15,000 years ago.
I know that I vision quested in a cave in Egypt, in the desert of Egypt, that the tools nearby were dated at 6,500, 7,000 years, and I've had people date this cave as being used as back as 14,000 years ago. It has handprints, and it's very isolated in the middle of the desert.
Wow, cool.
And you know that they were connected to Source, and that was a shamanic connection.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened in our culture is, you know, well, most of the Americans that weren't already here, well, now it's a real melting pot, but a lot of the immigrants came from Europe, and the Inquisitions pretty much cut off the hereditary rights of understanding nature and communion with nature and what would be considered the magical or shamanic arts that preceded that. And in the Industrial Revolution that followed and the rigid structures and dogmas of the religious traditions, it became not okay to hang out with serpents or you know, all those vanquished traditions were overlaid with all these other components that diluted and subdued the original direct source, because, you know, without an intercessor, who's going to get paid?
That's right.
So, but the old shamanic traditions that were not sullied or confused, and you can't find too many of them to study anymore.
Mm.
You know, I would say what comes to mind if I were looking for any place where you could still find a purity to it, and it's really been ravaged, is the Aboriginal.
Mm.
And there's that book, what was it called? Mutant Message from Down Under.
An Australian Aboriginal book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that described a bit of what I think the purity that, you know, there might be threads of it surviving.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've got a lot of healing to do on this
right.
planet. To recover our access.
You mentioned very early in the program when we were talking about competition sometimes that might rise up among different shamans or different groups among indigenous people or people that practice shamanic traditions, and it's common knowledge for people who study these things to know that, as you mentioned, that the mojo of the shaman, be he a male or a female or whatever, can be used for healing or it can be used for for less...
Power is a double-edged sword.
Right, right, right. So it's not always altruistic, and people have been known to use these things in an aggressive manner and to harm other people even. So you sort of implied something that, you know, earlier, that if a shaman comes on the scene, someone who can actually rise above that game and not and stay away from that one side of the double-edged sword that you mentioned, do you see that happening, or do you foresee it happening?
I foresee it. I see it. I know it's happening. I know that it's happening. There is so much going on, and it's still, you know, and it's moving rapidly, and it's spreading, and more people are getting turned on. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the 60s in the sense that, you know, we were taking acid and watching that spread and watching people get turned on. In 1964, I used to sit up on the Sunset Strip and watch people walk by, and there'd be these sort of stiff caricatures, and then there'd be this flexible person that's like a real person just kind of walking naturally, and others were more like caricatures.
Uh-huh.
And you'd watch the proportionate numbers change over time. I mean, of course, I was in California, so you could really see it spread and grow.
Right, you were right
being
at the
part
the,
of that
at
vanguard.
The center of it, yeah.
But I've been at this work for 25 years, and I've seen a huge movement. Just, it's incredible the numbers of people that are getting turned on to this awakening process and to the possibilities of self-empowerment and how we can heal ourselves and help heal others and in so doing help heal the world.
Mm.
And there's this tremendous upswelling and undercurrent that's growing rapidly. And it's, you know, I guess it's no accident that at the same time there's the intensification of the chaos as well.
Right.
And so I think we're moving toward a collective shamanic experience of a breakdown of the old and an emergence of something new and wonderful and hopeful.
Wow. Well, that's a notion that sort of comes through with many, many people that I talk to, and it's a personal impression of my own that I've come to. Well, in many ways from talking to people like yourselves, but again, you know, there's nothing like experience, and my own experiences have sort of led me in the same direction. And my gosh, something is happening here, and it's not being talked about on CNN. That's for sure. So
well, that is for sure. Have you met Thoth?
I'm sorry.
Have you met Thoth? Have you ever interacted directly with
Thoth? Well, I don't know. I mean, I've interacted with a number of.
You want to give it a shot on air?
Sure, let's go for it. I'd love to, and I'm sure that my listeners would be thrilled to have us do something like this.
So let me just kind of describe him, and then I'm just going to take you through a really simple breathing exercise and see if we can approach that way and give your listeners an experience and give you an experience that then maybe you can speak about.
Wonderful.
And so Thoth is that highest concept of mind. He represents wisdom in its highest form. And he's usually seen with an ibis head and a human body.
Mm-hmm.
But he can come as an ibis, sometimes a baboon, sometimes the serpent that offers that wisdom, you know, fruit of knowledge.
Sure.
Heard
that story, right, everybody?
Oh, yeah. It's right on the cover of my Egyptian Mysteries book.
Isn't that interesting?
So what I'm going to ask you to do in the alchemical healing work that I do, we always start with the heart. So I'm going to ask your listeners to just get yourself comfortable and close your eyes, take a minute to ground and center yourself, and put your attention on your heart. Find the eternal flame that dwells within the sanctuary of your heart. And as you bring that flame into focus, in whatever way you see it, however you perceive it, whether it's a candle or a campfire or a bonfire or a glow, feed it with love. Love is the fuel. Pour love upon the flame. And as you feed your flame, it grows. It brightens. It intensifies. And just continue pouring love upon your flame. And see if you can feel the radiance of the light of that flame as it moves through your body, as it grows, as you feed it. And then we're going to add to our feeding of the flame by breathing as though you're inhaling the power from the heart of the earth, pulling the earth, the power of the earth and the intelligence of all the forms and elements of the earth on your breath, drawing it up through the layers of the earth into your body and up to your heart. Let that feed and mingle with your heart flame. And then as you exhale, feel that moving out through your body, brightening that fire, brightening that light. Inhale once again from the earth, feeling the power and energy to come up into your body, into your heart, feeding your heart flame, then exhaling it out into the world in every direction. Now, while you're continuing to feed love to your heart flame, and while you're continuing to breathe up through the earth, put your attention to the heart of the cosmos, the heart of the universe, and breathe as though you're drawing your breath from above, pulling the energy from the stars and the galaxies in through your crown, down into your heart. Feel how that feeds your heart flame in a different way, mingles with the power of the earth and the power of your love, and then is expressed as light as you breathe out into the world. So as we breathe this heart breath, and the light gets brighter, look within that glow, within the very center of your heart, and see if you can find Thoth within. Just allow his image. It's okay to use your imagination. Imagination is the lightning rod of the shaman. Picture in whatever way you will, whether you see Thoth, envision him, simply know he's there, feel his presence. And then as he comes more into focus, and you can add your breath to help clarify that focus, open your heart, make eye contact, greet this being with respect. It's as though he steps out from that place within your heart and stands before you, facing you. And he's really pleased that we've honored him and called him forth in this way. And so he wishes to confer a blessing on you. It may come in the form of a message, some kind of attunement or empowerment, or the gift of some kind of tool of wisdom or healing that he offers to you. Just take a moment to have an experience direct with Thoth. Receive his message. And you may wish there might be a question that you'd like to ask for him that you need guidance on, something in your life that of import. And just kind of ask if he can assist you in finding a solution or giving you some direction.
May I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Is what we just did a general guideline? In other words, first you make contact, say hello, pass your greetings, and then sort of get down to business?
Usually.
Mm-hmm. Sort of, again, as you mentioned, very much like you might a normal conversation.
So I think some of your listeners might still be there, so let's give them a chance to receive whatever guidance is there for them in their quest or question. And he's likely to give you an experience or a different perspective or view of what you're looking at. And this is just an opportunity to begin to get a sense of how it is to be in communion with this divine being or the same protocol regardless of who it is. And then be sure and give gratitude to Thoth for whatever message or guidance he's given, for showing up, for being there for you, for letting you recognize this potent possibility in your life. And then perhaps you might want to make an arrangement to visit him in another time soon when you can take more time and get to know him, get to know that signature, the frequency or vibration that is alive in his presence, so that you can learn to distinguish this particular intelligence from another. And then ground and center. And open your eyes whenever you're ready. This, because we're on air and have so little time, I used a very short form. The map that I use to take people in alchemical healing and in my other book, Power Animal Meditations, is a different process, a different pathway through which you change your consciousness in order to perceive in these realms. And Thoth then becomes the guide that directs you to whatever ally or animal totem or experience that you need to respond to the questions that you bring.
Wow, wow, very interesting. And there's actually a change. You know, when you do something like that, Nikki, it's amazing because the atmosphere changes. I can feel it not only in the studio here, where I'm not alone. There's actually another person in the studio with me, and in the chat room, people that are listening, everything went silent. It's very weird what happens when you sort of invoke something like that. Whether people really it sort of happens whether you like it or not, almost.
Sometime we'll do this and we'll work on the alchemical healing, and I'll do healing demonstrations.
Hmm.
And we can pick somebody in your chat room, and I'll do a healing through the radio into the chat room.
That would be really interesting, yeah. Let me ask you, since we only have a few more minutes here before the top of the hour, about some of your own experiences with people who've been on some of these journeys that you've taken over the years. You go all around the planet, and we haven't talked enough about it. Some of these the healing journeys that you go on in a physical sense to sacred sites. All around the planet. What do you see from people participating in those? Are people getting help from these experiences?
They're pretty mind-blowing experiences. The people who choose to come on my tours are more pilgrim than tourist.
Hmm.
They're looking, they're questing, and they're looking for transformation or healing or a deeper meaning in life or to really understand through direct experience the cultures that we visit. I'm primarily focusing on Egypt right now. I do two trips a year myself, and one of my students is also leading trips. And I'm trying to, I don't have the dates yet, but we've got a trip going to Peru either late this year or early next spring, and that's also an extremely transformative experience because we work with a very fine shaman, a shaman of integrity that is really a warrior for healing the planet. And he's also extremely well-versed and articulate in the archaeology and the history, as well as he's an artist, a musician, and a shaman. And so there's a lot of really exciting experience that happens for people on the Peru trips. And then the other things that I'm doing, I'm doing a lot of phone work. I do teleseminars so that people don't have to travel. It's getting so much harder to fly around. And we have this technology, and I've discovered I can teach alchemical healing on the Tesla. And I do a free circle every month on the telephone to probably between 40 and 150 people for healing cancer.
Cool.
And then I do a 10-day alchemical healing seminar at my home in Eugene and an 8-day Egyptian mysteries retreat where people come and stay at my home. And that's pretty much what I'm focusing on now.
Do you have a plan to continue writing? Do you have another book in the works? Or
My husband and I are writing a book together. The next project that's actually going to be published, well, the Anubis Oracle is going to be published in October. And that's the deck and book that are the companion to the Shamanic Mysteries of Egypt. And we're very, very excited about that. That's co-authored with Linda Starwolf.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's the next thing that's coming up. And then I'm going to do a class for Sounds True on becoming an oracle.
Huh.
And that'll be out next May. And my husband and I are working on a planetary healing book that is sort of the next level after alchemical healing. We move from, you know, individuals healing individuals to how we can work together communally and make big changes really fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for a greater number of people and for the greater planet.
And that's what we're coming up. There's a lot of physics in it and you know, it's really a blend of physics, alchemy, and the Egyptian mysteries.
Hmm. Wow. Well, as you say, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So it's encouraging that you're out there doing so many things. Sort of a last question to finish things off. You know, people, as we've been sort of alluding to much of the program tonight, there is a particular percentage of the population, and none of us can really put our finger on how many, but there's a percentage that really is starting to awaken their own consciousness and become more involved, more interested, more understanding of who they are and where they come from, and just seekers of truth and information. But then there's another group that perhaps is further back along the curve. But for all the people, and you know, wherever they may fall in this, in the scheme of it, you know, what can people be doing to help themselves? In other words, these things we've been talking about tonight, can they be used, you know, for these personal transformations? And maybe, you know, some closing words about how, you know, maybe just a, you know, little bit of advice for how people can move along best in a world that's very disturbing and very confusing right now.
Well, first to realize that you have everything you need. It's just a matter of remembering that we have these tools. They are coming back. There's many, many people out there helping people rediscover and remember themselves. And you just have to find the right teachers, you know, that's through a heartful connection. And really feel who's the right one and who's got the tools that you need that you can best bring. And the next thing that I would say is there's still time and there's still hope and we can do it. We can turn this train around. We can become present and grow. And I guess presence is really the watchword, because it's by being fully present, aware, and awake that we can avail ourselves of all that's there for us. All the help we need is right there. We're just not noticing. We don't notice the miracles that are happening around us 24/7. And it's because we're either driven by our supposed survival needs or are mesmerized or escaping with TV or whatever distractions are going on. But when we bring ourselves fully present and in the moment, that's when we begin to touch the magic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there. It is so there for everyone. And I hope that some of you will choose to come play with me.
Well, that is a wonderful way to wrap things up. I want to thank you so much, Nikki. It's been a really wonderful conversation, and I'm so pleased that we got a chance to talk. And then thanks for the work that you're doing. It's remarkable stuff, and you're in cahoots with a whole bunch of really good people.
Well, thank you. I very much enjoyed this evening with you.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful night and the rest of the week, and take care of yourself, and we'll talk
again,
okay?
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, everybody. Nikki Scully on the web at NikkiScully.com, and also Shamanic Journeys, ShamanicJourneys.com. You can find out information about Nikki and what she's doing. If you're lucky enough, maybe one of these trips that she has coming up in the next couple of years, you could get in on. Now, I know that they're booked for the next few, but you know, you got to plan things out quite a bit these days if you want to do something like that. So, at any rate, thanks again to Nikki. That was fun, and I am glad we had a chance to talk. So, it is now just a few minutes before 1 o'clock in the morning, now on the 8th of April, 2008, and it's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Let's take a little break here and play a piece of music from Finn O'Loughlin. This one is called Racing Against the Time. Be back in just a few minutes, and carry on with the program.
Heart in their lives, too many people lost and deprived, so many.
Lachlan. That's called Racing Against the Time. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And just about 1 o'clock now in the morning, and it's a pleasure to be with you all there tonight. I would like to say hello to everybody listening to the program tonight, wherever you may be, if you're listening over the traditional airwaves on the radio or over the web, through the archives, live or otherwise. It's a pleasure to have y'all listen to the program one way or the other, okay? Every week we do this on Monday, 11 p.m., broadcast a show here from the wonderful studios of KOPN in downtown Columbia, Missouri, and stream the show on the Internet as well. On the web, kopn.org, you'll have to click on the Listen Live button, and you'll get a nice Internet stream from anywhere on the planet, as long as you got a decent connection, okay? All right, thanks to everybody who helps make that happen, live on the radio and on the net, and everybody who helps me in my own endeavor on the web, including Larry Noriger and Chaos for setting up the chat room, and everybody who participates in the program every week and makes the whole thing what it is. So anyway, if you're interested in seeing what I'm talking about, check it out on the web, www.mikehagan.com. You can see what we're doing over there and have access to all of it. And if you're an artist, you can share some of your own art with us, and we'll try to find a place for it up there on the website and share it with other people, okay? All right, once again, on the web, MikeHagan, H-A-G-A-N.com. Share your thoughts, and I'll be happy to share mine back with you, okay? We have a forum, which I may take a peek in here in a bit to talk about some news, but the forum bulletin board is always active, and there's always lots of interesting topics being discussed over there by who knows who. And a live chat room up and active right now and during the week whenever you decide to use that. So lots of things that we're trying to do to keep people up and interested and connected. And you're welcome to join us in any of those particular venues, okay? All right, my email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send me email. And same goes for the guests and musicians that appear on the program. Everybody likes to hear from you, and we'll be glad to engage in a dialectic, as they say, as long as you're friendly folk, you know what I mean? All right, once again, on the web, MikeHagan.com. Phone number here in the studio, 573-443-8255. If anybody wants to call and say hi, you're welcome to. And be glad to chat with you. We got an hour left in the program here. I got a few things that I can fill in with in between now and 2 a.m., but if anybody has anything they'd like to talk about, 573-443-8255. I'd be glad to talk with you on the air, and I'll try to get my telephone over here in front of my face so you don't call and then leave, and then I leave you hanging. I've done that before. I tell people call in, and I'll talk to you on the air, and then people call and I never answer the phone because I don't even see it ringing, and I get too lost in my own world, as you all know. Sometimes I can sort of get going like the Energizer Bunny to sort of wind me up, and it's very, very hard to stop me sometimes. So at any rate, the phone number, once again, 573-443-8255 if you want to chat, all right? Okay, upcoming guests, I'll tell you a little bit about what's happening in the next few weeks. Nikki Scully, of course, was this evening. Thank you, Nikki. Wonderful conversation on the web at nikkiscully.com. Next week, our good friend, Kent Stedman, back among us on the 14th of April. Mr. Kent Stedman, the wonderful wizard of cyberspaceorbit.com. It's been too long since we've had the Bard on the air with us, and so we will remedy that next week. Mr. Kent Stedman, one of my best friends in the world, and somebody who I just think is doing extraordinary work and has been for a long, long time. So anyway, be a great fun time next week to be had by all when Kent Stedman joins us from cyberspaceorbit.com. On the 21st of April, Sterling Allen. He's a man who knows a whole lot about alternative energy, all different sorts. And we'll talk with Sterling about as many of those things as we can. On the 28th of April, it's sort of a scheduled conflict. It's very possibly going to be Dr. Rustam Roy, but it may possibly be Dr. Neil Goldsmith. I'm not sure how the 28th is going to work out, but either way, it should be an interesting show. Dr. Rustam Roy is a remarkable material scientist, a professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, and just a guy whose accomplishments, publications, books, papers are just too numerous to go into here on the air. But he has made some absolutely remarkable discoveries in the last couple of years, and they involve things that a lot of people that listen to the program are interested in, structured water being one of them, the medicinal antibacterial and antifungal and antiviral properties of silver. Dr. Roy is involved in that whole endeavor. And most recently, a way to burn water as a fuel. So, and all this stuff, you know, in peer-reviewed scientific journals now. So Dr. Rustam Roy, that should be an absolutely thrilling conversation when we get him on the air. I'm hoping within the next couple of weeks. on the 28th of April. However, it may be Dr. Neil Goldsmith, the former editor of Omni magazine, another guy who's just done remarkable things over a very long career. We'll speak with both of those guys eventually here in the next few weeks, okay? Richard Allen Miller will be here with me in the studio on the 5th of May. Rick will be here in Columbia, and, well, my God, who knows what the hell is going to happen with Rick Miller in the studio. It's crazy enough when I'm talking to him from his place in Oregon. I can't imagine being face-to-face with the guy. He's a wild man, but he's also a freaking complete genius and a polymath of sorts. He knows a tremendous amount about many, many, many different topics. So Richard Allen Miller here with me live in the studio on the 5th of May. And if, you can get down here, come on down, and we'll meet you at the Blue Fugue before the show for a few beers, okay? All right, Bill Murphy. Bill Murphy is the chief operating officer of an organization that's called GATA, G-A-T-A. And if you're interested in economical interests or economical concerns, I guess, concerns of economics, GATA is an abbreviation for the Gold Antitrust Association. And Bill Murphy is a really, really interesting guy, and he knows a lot about what's happening in the world of high finance, as it were. So we'll talk with Bill probably at the beginning of one of these programs over the next few weeks. We probably won't have him for the entire program, but maybe do 45 minutes or an hour with Bill Murphy from GATA sometime in April. Harvey Arden, he's a Lakota elder who I've been in contact with for the last few months, and Harvey will be on the program sometime probably in May. Still working on David Abram. There were a number of listeners who had asked that I try to get Dr. Werner Vinge on the program. Of course, Werner Vinge, some people pronounce it, I guess, is the man credited with the word and the concept of the singularity. However, Dr. Vinge was nice enough to get back to me, but his schedule just apparently is not going to allow him to do the program. But I appreciate his candor, and he's doing amazing work regardless. So if we can't have him on the program and you're interested in his work, well, just go learn as much as you can and then post it up there on the forum, okay? And we'll do our best to share it with other people. Graham Hancock later this year, and, well, we'll have to see what else rolls along this summer, okay? All right, it is Mike, and you are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Once again, the phone number here, 573-443-8255. If you want to call and chat, I'd be glad to talk with you on the air. 573-443-8255. All right, let's do space weather, and then we'll take a little break, I think, and come back and talk a little bit about some of the things that are in the news, unless we get some phone calls here, okay? All right, if you want to get in a moon buggy race, well, you're too late, because the 15th annual NASA's Great Moon Buggy Race has already crossed the finish line, and the winner can be found on the web at spaceweather.com. Sort of a silly story, but I always thought as a kid when I was watching those astronauts walk around up there on the moon, and they had, I always thought the coolest thing about it was the buggy, their little space cart that they had, like a little go-kart. And I've always wanted a go-kart. I never ever had one, and I still want one, and I think it's because of seeing those guys up there tooling around on the moon 30 years ago in their little space buggy. Well, we haven't been to the moon in a long time. They say they're going to go back there in 2018 or some nonsense like that, but I'm just interested, frankly, in the buggy. let's see. Speaking of the moon, well, if you go out tomorrow night, or I guess it's tonight, the 8th, you'll see just a sliver of a crescent moon, new moon yesterday on the 6th, and you'll get this waxing crescent now for the next week or so. And the moon is going to make a very cool passage by the Pleiades star cluster. And it'll be a very pleasant view if you have a good clear sky and a decent view of the moon come tomorrow night. You'll be able to see the moon, have a little rendezvous there with the Pleiades. And the Pleiades, of course, a star system or a star cluster that is, you know, talked about a lot in mythology, actually. Even in the Christian Bible, they talk about the Pleiades, but also in UFO lore and all this sort of stuff. So anyway, tomorrow night, the moon and Pleiades coming real close to one another. All right, what else is happening? Well, the International Space Station, of course, if you're up at the right time of day or night, you can see her gliding by in the sky. I don't think that's anything that's too exciting, actually. We've been able to look at satellites and things like that that cross over our heads for quite some time. The International Space Station, I always wonder what they're doing up there, you know, and if it's really worth anybody's while. It still seems to me to be just, you know, old sort of bucket of bolts technology, and I really don't, at least what they show to us, you know, us lay people, maybe they're doing something really fantastic up there, who knows, but I don't know, seems sort of doubtful. At any rate, as always, things happening up there, the best way to find out is to go outside and look up, and if you do that for any amount of time, day or night, the odds are you'll see something interesting. It might just be a red-tailed hawk, but you know, who knows? It might be a flying saucer or the moon and the Pleiades dancing up there above your heads, okay? All right. It is 15 minutes after the hour, and I'm going to take a break here, play a piece of music from Finn O'Loughlin. We'll come back and talk about lots of other stuff, all right? This one is called Ode to FZ Part 1.
Their themes are always the same, animals, hunters, and... What is this strange creature with the bulbous head? Who are the figures at his feet, helmeted in the fashion of today's divers or astronauts? No eyes, no nose.
Ode to FZ Part 1. That's Finn O'Loughlin. Great music from Mr. Finn, and I appreciate him sharing it with me and with you all. All right, it's Mike, and it's 20 after 1, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And once again, 573-443-8255. Everybody says I don't take phone calls enough. Not everybody, but I get plenty of people that say, hey, you never take any phone calls. So I'm trying to take phone calls. You got to call. You know, you wonder why I don't take any calls when nobody ever calls me. Then I look silly. Then I look silly when, hey, let's open the phone lines and nobody calls. Like, oh, who am I talking to, myself? Apparently. All right. Anyway, cyberspaceorbit.com. I mentioned that Kent is going to be on the air with us next week. Well, you should check out his website between now and then, because he has some amazing stuff up there on the front page right now. A number of things that we could chat about next week, and a couple that I might talk about here in just a little bit. But at any rate, cyberspaceorbit.com, lots of stuff to take a look at before we have Kent on the air with us next week. Right now at the front, or at the top of his page, is a depiction of the Large Hadron Super Collider, this project that's about to be undergone in Switzerland at one of the major atom smashers on the planet, this place that they call CERN. At any rate, the Large Hadron Collider is scheduled to go live next month sometime in May. And, well, they have all kinds of speculation about what they're trying to do and what they're trying to discover and what may happen and what may not happen. And there are people that are all bent out of shape about it. And there's even a lawsuit, actually, that's been filed against these guys to stop them from doing the experiment because there are scientists involved in the project that have made statements on the record that say that there's not a zero chance. I talked about this last week, I think, but there's not a zero chance that the Large Hadron Collider could destroy the world and open up a black hole right there in Switzerland. It just swallows up everything, and who knows what else. But I'm skeptical of any particular exciting news to come out of CERN. Frankly, I think most of this is bluster and PR and propaganda, to be honest. I've never been a big fan of particle physics. The best, although something good may actually come out of it for once, because of the technological requirements of this particular project, the Large Hadron Super Collider, which is something that's been postponed and delayed and talked about for a long, long time now. If you go back in the Orbit archives, I guarantee you'll find me talking about the Large Hadron Collider at CERN probably at least 3 years ago. And I'll believe it when they actually fire this thing up. But at any rate, one of the offshoots of this project is a computer system that's been developed in Switzerland that that could allow a much greater experience on the internet. The idea is that machines and the system itself could operate up to 10,000 times faster than your best broadband connections right now. And there's an interesting story in the Telegraph, the London Telegraph, from the UK, and the title of the article reads, "Super Fast Internet May Replace World Wide Web. The Internet could soon be made obsolete by a new grid system which is 10,000 times faster than broadband connections. Scientists in Switzerland had developed a lightning-fast replacement to the Internet that would allow feature films and music catalogs to be downloaded within seconds. The invention could signal the end of the dreaded frozen screen when computers seize up after being asked to process too much information." Anyway, so this is a spin-off from the particle physics laboratory there at CERN, and we'll have to see if any of this comes to fruition. But I'd love to see an internet that was 10,000 times faster than the one that I use now. So we'll have to see. All right, what else do I have here for you? Anyway, that's on Ken Stedman's front page and a whole bunch of other stuff. So take a look there and snoop around a little bit before we do the program with Kent next week, okay? Once again, 573-443-8255 if you want to call and talk, and I'd be glad to chat with you. I wanted to mention that I spoke with Elizabeth Rauscher today. Speaking of particle physics, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, she's been on the program before, and she's a world-renowned physicist herself and somebody who is right in the middle of much of this revolutionary physics that's being rediscovered and better understood around the world. Elizabeth Rauscher, she is not particularly involved in this project at CERN, and I'm glad because, as I said, I don't think it's that big of a deal. Anyway, Elizabeth is going to be on the program again sometime, probably in May or June, but she's got a couple of conferences that are coming up that she wanted to talk to me about that are really exciting, and one of them is a Native American conference. Elizabeth, for whatever reason, she wanted to talk with me about that stuff. She has a Hopi connection, actually, and spent much of her childhood on Native Hopi land down there in the Four Corners area. And we had a very interesting conversation that had nothing to do with physics, and it was really cool. And she's going to be talking about some of that background, that part of her life, in a conference in a few weeks. And after she does that, we're going to schedule something to have her back on the air, so we're going to talk a little bit about art and creativity and imagination and Native wisdom and medicine. So, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, it was a thrill to talk with her on the phone today, and I'm looking forward to having her back on the air here to talk about some things that she doesn't normally talk about in public. So we'll do that with Elizabeth Rauscher sometime in the next couple months. Today, the 8th of April, is the anniversary of the passing of Pablo Picasso, one of the most remarkable painters of all time, if you ask me, and an amazing individual and a remarkable personality, a great figure in history, frankly, Pablo Picasso. I have this wonderful videotape that's called The Mystery of Picasso, and it's from like 1959, I think, something like that. It's on DVD now. You can actually order it, I think, online. It was very hard to get for a while, but now I think it sort of proliferated itself. But it was real cool because Picasso was an eccentric sort, as you can imagine, and wasn't really into the media and wasn't really into having his picture taken and wasn't really into, you know, doing interviews and this sort of stuff. And he was very particular about it when he did. And he had never allowed anyone to watch him paint, to film it or anything like that. Well, there's a famous journalist, and I forget his name, but he's the guy who was instrumental in making this particular documentary. But he got the approval from Picasso to do this project, and it turned out to be really cool. They eventually named it The Mystery of Picasso, and the way that the film is done, they actually do a lot of filming of his actual artwork, of him actually painting. And the problem that they had to deal with, or one of the challenges, was if you had a camera and you wanted to watch Picasso paint live, well, the camera would have to be behind him if you wanted to see the canvas, and his body would be blocking most of what he was doing. So the way they resolved this was they decided to have him paint on glass, and they put the camera on the backside, and so you're watching Pablo Picasso paint on a piece of glass as if you were inside your home and he was outside painting on the window. And the whole thing is filmed, and there's some interesting discussion between the photographer and the artist. And it is absolutely a remarkable, remarkable visual trip. You know, we're talking about shamanic journeys. Well, without any drums or without any psilocybin or without any yoga or without beating yourself to death in the forest, you can watch Pablo Picasso paint. And, man, if you just breathe deeply and, you know, twist a bomber in the meantime, you'll probably be able to go anywhere. I mean, this is just remarkable stuff, and it just takes me away every time I watch it. I have a 4.5-year-old son, as some of you may know, and this is the first thing that I allowed him to watch on the television. The first thing that he was allowed to watch was The Mystery of Picasso. Never saw anything else on the TV before. And he was quite old, I mean, relatively speaking. I think my kid was 3 before he watched the television or something. But anyway, and I don't say that with snobbery. I just mean that was just what we choose. We just don't watch much TV around my place. And the kids really don't have much interest in it. Turns out if the parents don't have much interest in it, the kids won't have much interest in it. They're pretty much into what you're into. They sort of, it really is a sort of monkey see, monkey do sort of thing. And if you're doing stuff other than watching the TV, they'll probably be doing other things as well. But anyway, Pablo Picasso, here's to you, grandfather. 4/8/1973, he passed away, and here's to him today. All right? One other person of note, Luther Burbank. He passed away on the 11th of April, 1926. And he was, of course, this amazing botanist, famous for the Burbank russet potato that many of you have eaten over the course of these last 100 years since he developed it and invented it. And Burbank was responsible for creating, literally, new species of all kinds of plants and vegetables. And he was a magician of sorts, a shaman, an alchemist when it came to plants. And to this day, there's really no one who has been able to document how he did what he did, because Luther Burbank was creating new species of plants long before genetic engineering or any of this stuff was even around. But he was able to coax plants to reform their own progeny and create different plants and plants that were actually sort of created to his own specifications. He was a hero like a rock star type hero. If you were in California in the 1920s, my God, you knew Luther Burbank. I mean, he was like the man, and everybody loved him because he was considered just like this, like a magician. He was able to do things with plants that nobody else could do. And this was a time when plants were much more important to the general population than they are now. We've become much more removed from our food sources over the course of the centuries. And 100 years ago, people were much closer to their food sources than they are today, and they understood much better what it took, you know, to raise certain plants and to be able to be successful with personal farming and gardens and this sort of stuff. And Burbank, what he did was essentially take orders. You know, people would say, "Well, we need a tomato that can do better, you know, in a more arid environment where there's not as much sunshine, you know." And long before the days of Monsanto and this sort of thing, Luther Burbank was able to create, plants that did exactly what they were requested to do. It'd take him a couple of years to get it together, you know, a couple of generations, but he was able to do it. Anyway, remarkable man and a very interesting story, the story of Luther Burbank. He passed away on the 11th of April, 1926. So, my assumption of what he was doing was just he just talked to the plants. I mean, he did what Nikki alluded to in our conversation earlier tonight. You know, he had a relationship. And once that relationship is established, well, if you can communicate over it, you just ask, hey, you know, could you try to do this? Maybe the plant will try to do it. I don't know. Get a good assumption as any, I guess. So, anyway, Pablo Picasso, Luther Burbank, here's to you both, all right? Let's see, now, the phone, 573-443-8255, if you want to call. Be glad to chat with you, okay? It is about 25 minutes before the end of the program here. Let me take a look in the chat room here. And goodbye to some of you who have left, and hello to those of you who are still there. And I'm sorry for those of you who are having difficulty with computers if you're having trouble keeping your connection there in the chat room. You can't blame that one on me, okay? All right. Let me play one more piece of music here because it's a good one, and then we'll... Then we'll come back and do a couple things from the news before the end of the program, okay? Once again, here's your chance, 573-443-8255. Anything you want to talk about, I'd be glad to chat with you. So give me a call if you like. In the meantime, once again, Finn O'Loughlin. And this one is called War Pigs.
At black masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerers of death's construction, in the fields the bodies burning as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning our brainwashed minds. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave that role to the pawn. Time will tell. Making war just for fun, treating people just like pawns in chess. Wait till their judgment day comes. Thank you.
darkness world stops turning. Ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power. Hand of God has struck the hour. Day of judgment, world is calling. On the knees the war pigs crawling, begging mercy for their sin. Laughing spreads his wings.
There you have it, War Pigs. Wonderful cover of that old Black Sabbath tune, and coming to you here from Finn O'Loughlin, and you're listening to it on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Mike Hagan, Radio Orbit. I just looked in the chat room, and somebody had posted a YouTube video of Dennis McKenna, talking at the World Psychedelic Forum, which was, very recent, actually. And I'm not really interested in talking about that, although it's interesting, but you can go check it out for yourself. But I did talk with Dennis on Wednesday, the third, last Wednesday. And actually, it was Thursday, I guess, April 3rd. That was the eighth anniversary of Terrence's death. And I usually talk with Dennis on that day, but this last Thursday, I had another reason to talk to him. It was very weird. The day before, on the 2nd, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who is a wonderful evolutionary biologist from Cambridge in the UK, and of course, you know, very highly regarded and controversial, certainly. But Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, you know, an icon, and certainly somebody who's very involved in the new ideas of consciousness and the studies of the mind and the brain and the heart and the way all these things work together. Rupert, of course, is the owner of the idea of morphic resonance, and a very interesting evolutionary idea that sort of throws a monkey wrench into many of the old ideas, but one that makes a whole lot of sense to a lot of people. Anyway, Terrence and Rupert were close friends when Terrence was still alive, and Dennis and Rupert maintain a friendship, and I know Rupert. I don't know if I'd say we're friends, but we're certainly acquaintances and chat over email often enough. Anyway, Rupert was giving a talk at a conference in New Mexico here in the States, and some crazy person went up on the stage and stabbed him. He's okay, but it was just one of these very strange events. And if you read the story about it, if you go onto my website and go over there to the main forum, the Radio Orbit forum, you could read about this. And it's just a generally strange story all around. But I wanted to just give a shout out to Rupe and say I hope you're doing well and feeling okay and recovering fully and completely from a less than pleasant experience. And you know, that's just sort of what's happening these days. For some people, all you got to do is talk about, you know, new ideas of the way that the world works and the way that human beings might actually be human, and they'll throw people into a complete fit. Now, there are some, you know, that will say, "Oh, well, this is, you know, the MK Ultra Manchurian candidate, you know, sent to go assassinate Rupert on the anniversary of his friend's death, you know, or something like that." But I don't particularly subscribe to that sort of thing. But I certainly think that there are some people that are very disturbed out there, and there are some people who aren't. And so your best bet is to try to hang with the people that aren't. All right. And I'm not trying to make light. Everybody's, you know, nobody wants to go through experiences like that. You know, there are way too many people that are subjected to violence in not just in our culture, but all around this planet. And, you know, it's no fun for anybody. So, you know, just be nice. All right. Now, here's the article that I dug up out of the archives that was, I mentioned Dr. Rustam Roy. He's going to be on the program sometime in the next month or so. Well, the reason that I went and tracked him down was because there's a story from May 28th, 2007. This is just under a year ago. And here's how the story reads. A Florida man may have accidentally invented a machine that could solve the gasoline and energy crisis plaguing the U.S., WBPF News 25 reported. Sanibel Island resident John Kansias is a former broadcast executive from Pennsylvania who wondered if his background in physics and radio could come in handy in treating the disease from which he suffers, cancer. Kansias invented a machine that emits radio waves in an attempt to kill cancerous cells while leaving normal cells intact. While testing his machine, he noticed that his invention had other unexpected abilities. Filling a test tube with salt water from a canal in his backyard, Kansias placed a tube and a paper towel in the machine and turned it on. Suddenly, the paper towel ignited, lighting up the tube like it was a wax candle. Pretty neat, huh? Kansias says. At any rate, what is happening here is the salt water is actually burning. And this has now been confirmed in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. And the guy that wrote the paper is Dr. Rustam Roy. And the way I understand it, what is happening is an RF wave is generated through the medium of salt water, and that frequency is I forget the actual frequency. It's noted in the paper. At any rate, and it's not that specific, it's a range of frequencies. So you shoot an RF wave through a medium of salt water, and the RF excites the water molecules to the extent that the bond between the hydrogen and the oxygen atoms is broken. And then, you know, when that happens, well, shoot, you got hydrogen as a fuel and oxygen as a catalyst, and it'll burn as long as you got fuel, as long as there's water there, and as long as you continue to apply the RF to it. Now, you know, there are questions of, is it an exothermic reaction? You know, is there more energy being output than is input? I don't know particulars about this right now. I think that it's very interesting that the thing is actually possible to begin with. We'll have to find out where it goes. But it's a very interesting story, and one that's been developing for about a year. And the fact that Rustam Roy, who is a very, very distinguished materials scientist and a professor emeritus in Pennsylvania, and who holds a professorship at the University of Arizona. And, I mean, the guy's bio is amazing. In fact, I will, since I got a couple minutes here, I'll see if I can pull it up real fast. let's see if we can find his biography, Rustam Roy. Let's see, we'll put his bio here, B-I-O. Rustam Roy, biography. Check this out, all right? This is just a little bit about Rustam Roy. Newsweek has accurately described Dr. Rustam Roy as the leading contrarian among U.S. scientists. The House of Representatives Committee on Science, Technology, and Research gave him its only standing ovation in 16 years after one of his recent testimonies. Rustam Roy is among two or three active leading material scientists in the United States, the author of over 1,000 papers with major contributions to real science, from glass ceramics to SOL gel technology to diamond films to nanocomposites. He is the senior-most member in the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, specializing in ceramic materials, today one of the hottest fields in science. He is a foreign member of the Swedish, Japanese, and Indian National Academies. I mean, this goes on and on and on. Dr. Rustam Roy is a pioneer and a man who to this day is just doing remarkable work. And anyway, he's confirmed this ability of salt water to burn once you pass an appropriate RF wave through it. And we'll talk with him about that and a number of his other discoveries on the air here in the next month or so, hopefully on the 28th of April, okay? We talked a little bit about the super-fast Internet that may replace the World Wide Web, one of the few positive things to come out of particle physics, perhaps. Levitation, altered states of consciousness, sex, drugs, and money. The Southland Tales, one of my friends, Ian, talking about a good movie called The Southland Tales. Don't know much about it, but there it is. A couple more minutes left to call if you want, 573-443-8255. That's the number. Elliot Spitzer, people talking about Spitzer, the former governor of New York, and what the behind-the-scenes story was on his political assassination, I guess is the best way to put that. There's a cool YouTube video, Jesus Loves Mushrooms. Allegra will tell you Jesus was a mushroom. There's another one. The Radio Orbit Astro Chart. Thanks to Hemp Penitz for putting together the chart for Orbit. That was pretty cool, and I liked seeing how that thing sort of rolls along. Now, here's one last thing that's sort of note, and of course, you know, people will argue what it really means, but I just thought it was cool to watch. Somebody posted on YouTube, I guess, Mike Wallace, you know, who's an old school journalist, and I don't know if he's still around. Is Mike Wallace still doing interviews and still working for one of the major networks? Well, this is from 1957, and Mike Wallace is interviewing Major Donald Kehoe. And Kehoe is an interesting figure in military history. Anyway, they're talking about flying saucers. And it's just a very interesting and sort of enlightening conversation because you can sort of see what was on the minds of people that were sort of in the thick of that whole thing back before it really became the... the mess that it is today. Anyway, Mike Wallace interviewing Major Donald Kehoe, 1957, about flying saucers and UFOs. Very interesting piece of old school video material, and we've got that up on the web as well in the Radio Orbit forum. So go there and check it out, along with a whole bunch of other interesting things. Okay, all right. Look, we've got about 6 minutes left in the program. My good friend Ruth just walked in the door. Get ready for a little crash landing. She'll be playing some music for you all for the next 3 or 3.5 hours or so. So I'm going to turn it over to Ruth in just a moment here. We'll close out with one more song from Finn O'Loughlin. And we'll come back and talk with you all next week. As I mentioned, Kent Stedman, www.cyberspaceorbit, CYBERSPACE, cyberspaceorbit.com. Kent will be with us next week. He's been on the program many times before, and it's a pleasure to have him back on the program next week. And, oh my gosh, it's been so long that I'm sure Kent will have all kinds of interesting things to talk with you about. We'll probably talk about what it's like to die, because he almost died this winter. I thought he was going to leave us, but he didn't, and I'm very pleased. And so, Kent Stedman, next Monday from cyberspaceorbit.com. Bye, Chris. Thanks, man. And, I guess that's it. Thank you all very much for listening to the program. Enjoy the week, and take care of yourself and those in your circle. All right? Here's a song. It's called Blues for America. Once more, Finn O'Loughlin, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. You've been listening to Radio Orbit.
Smidgen of foolish rules of ancient date, designed to make you all feel weak when you fall, spindle and mutilate those unbelievers from a neighboring state. Come on over, yes we are. Come on over, near and far. Come on over, left and right. People, we is not reptile. Come on over, yes we are. Come on over, near and far. Left and right.